This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present In the Heart of Darkness by David Drake and Eric Flint, narrated by Pete Bradbury. Prologue. When the lavish dinner was finished and the servants sent away, the spymaster broke the bad news. "Belisarius is alive," he said curtly. There were seven other men in the room. One, like the spymaster, was foreign. From the blankness of his face, it was obvious he had already heard the news. Of the Romans in the room, five rose up on their couches, their faces expressing various degrees of consternation. The seventh man, the last of the Romans, simply curled his lip and satisfied himself with shifting his weight to the other elbow. He had been disgusted the entire evening. The two churchmen in the room disgusted him with their sanctimonious prattle. Glycerius of Chalcedon and George Barsimes were deacons, acting on behalf of Rufinus Nemesianus, Bishop of Ravenna. They were rabidly orthodox, but at bottom their orthodoxy was nothing but a veil for ambition. The Bishop of Ravenna sought the papacy, and his underlings sought the patriarchates of Constantinople and Alexandria. Ambition was the seventh man's motive also, but he didn't disguise it with false piety. A ridiculous piety to boot, allying with Hindu heathens against Christian heretics. The seventh man counted many sins against his soul, mortal and venial alike, but hypocrisy was not among them. The two noblemen in the room disgusted him with their swaggering braggadocio. Their names were Hypatius and Pompeius. They were brothers, the nephew of the former Emperor Anastasius. By any formal dynastic criterion, they were the rightful heirs to the imperial throne. But Romans had never worshipped the altar of heredity. Competence was the ultimate standard for wearing the purple. And if there were two more feckless creatures in the entire Roman Empire, they were hiding themselves well. The other high Roman official in the room disgusted him. John of Cappadocia, his name was, and he was Emperor Justinian's Praetorian prefect. A ruthless and capable man, to be sure, but one whose rapaciousness and depravity were almost beyond belief. Murderer, thief, extortionist, torturer, rapist, all these things John of Cappadocia had been named. The names were all true. The two Malwa spies in the room disgusted him, Balban the oily spymaster even more than Ajatashatru the assassin, partly for their false bonhomie and pretense of comradeship, but mostly for their claim of disinterested concern for the best interests of Rome, which no one but an idiot would believe for an instant. The seventh man was very far from being an idiot, and he took the Malwa air of innocence as an insult to his intelligence. The seventh man was disgusted with himself. He was the Grand Chamberlain of the Roman Empire. He was one of the most valued and trusted advisers of Emperor Justinian, whom he planned to betray. He was the close personal friend of Empress Theodora, whom he planned to murder. He would add the count of treason to his sins and increase the counts of murder, and all for the sake of rising one small rung in power. He was a eunuch, and so he could never aspire to the throne himself, but he could at least become the Grand Chamberlain of a feckless emperor, instead of a dynamic one, and thus be the real power in Rome. The seventh man knew, with all the intelligence of a keen mind, that his ambition was stupidity incarnate. He was an old man. Even if he realized his ambition, he would probably not enjoy its exercise for more than a few years. For that stupid, petty ambition, the seventh man risked the possibility of execution and the certainty of eternal damnation. He despised himself for that pettiness, and was disgusted by his own stupidity. But he could not do otherwise. For all that he prided himself on his iron self-control, the seventh man had never been able to control his ambition. Ambition rode the eunuch like lust rides a satyr. It had ridden him as far back as he could remember, since the days when other boys had taunted and beaten him for his castrated deformity. But above all, the seventh man was disgusted because the Malwa and the Roman reactionaries in the room had insisted on dining in the archaic tradition, instead of sitting on chairs at a table, as all sensible people did in the modern day. The seventh man's aged body had long since lost the suppleness to eat a meal half reclined on a couch. His name was Narses, and his back hurt. The Indian spymaster's eyes had been fixed on Narses from the moment he made the announcement. Months ago, Balban had realized that the eunuch was by far the most formidable of his Roman allies, and the only one who was not in any sense a dupe. The churchmen were provincial bigots, the royal nephews were witless fops, and John of Cappadocia, for all his undoubted ability, was too besotted with his own vices to distinguish fact from fancy. But Narses understood the Malwa plot perfectly. He had agreed to join it simply because he was convinced he could foil the Malwa after he had taken the power in Rome. Balban was not at all sure the eunuch was wrong in that estimate. Narses, in power, would make a vastly more dangerous enemy for the Malwa than Justinian. So Balban had long since begun planning for Narses' own assassination. But he was a methodical man who knew the value of patience, and was willing to take one step ahead of the other. For the moment, the alliance with the eunuch was necessary. And so, "What is your reaction, Narses?" he asked. The Indian's Greek was fluent, if heavily accented. The eunuch grimaced as he painfully levered himself to an upright posture on his couch. "I told you it was a stupid idea," he growled. As always, Balban was struck by the sound of such a deep, rich, powerful voice coming from such a small and elderly man. A eunuch, to boot. "It was not," whined Hypatius. His brother's vigorous nod of agreement was intended to be firm and dignified. With his cosmetic adorned and well-coiffed head bobbing back and forth on a scrawny neck, the nobleman resembled nothing so much as a doll shaken by a toddler. The eunuch fixed muddy green eyes on the nephews. Against his bony face, surrounded by myriad wrinkles, the effect was utterly reptilian. Deadly, but cold-blooded. The brothers shrank from his gaze like mice. Narses satisfied himself with that silent intimidation. Much as he was often tempted, Narses never insulted the brothers. One of them would be needed in the future for his puppet emperor. Either one, it didn't matter. Whichever summoned up the courage to plot with Narses to murder the other first. So, as always, the eunuch maintained formal respect, and allowed his eyes alone to establish dominance. "I told you all from the beginning that the plan was pathetic," he said. "If you want to assassinate a man like Belisarius, you had better use something other than common criminals." Ajatashatru spoke for the first time that evening. He was the Indian mission's chief agent, a specialist in direct action, a man of the streets and alleys where Balban manipulated from the shadows. His Greek was also fluent, but unlike Balban's, bore hardly a trace of an accent. Ajatashatru could, and often did, pass himself off as a Roman citizen from one of the more exotic outlying provinces of the empire. A dark-complected Syrian, perhaps, or a half-breed Isaurian. "It was a well-laid plan, according to the report," he murmured. His tone exuded calm, dispassionate assessment. Belisarius was ambushed shortly after landing in Barracucha, at night, in darkness, while he was alone without his cataphract bodyguards, by no less than 8 dacoits, seasoned killers, all of them. "Really?" sneered Narses. He was quite happy to insult the Malwa, within reason, so he allowed his lip to curl ferociously, but refrained from spitting on the polished parquet floor. "Tell me, Ajatashatru, I'm curious. How many of these, what did you call them? Oh, yes, seasoned killers, no less. How many of them survived the encounter?"
3, came the instant reply. "They fled after Belisarius slaughtered the first 5, within seconds, according to the report."
Narses' sneer faded. Ajatashatru was immune to the Roman's contempt. The agent's dark brown eyes were filled with nothing beyond professional interest, and the eunuch well remembered that Ajatashatru had expressed his own reservations at the meeting, many months earlier, when the decision was taken to recommend Belisarius' assassination as soon as he reached India. Recommend, not order. Lord Venon de Catra was the one who would make the final decision. Balban ranked high in the Malwa Empire's hierarchy, but he was not a member of the imperial dynastic clan. He did not give orders to such as Venon de Catra, not if he wanted to live. Narses sighed, as much from the pain in his back as exasperation.
"I told you then," he continued, "that you were grossly underestimating Belisarius."
A rare moment of genuine anger heated his voice.
Who did you think you were playing with for the sake of God? He demanded. The man is one of the greatest generals Rome has ever produced, and he's still young and vigorous and famous for his bladesmanship, and has more combat experience than most soldiers twice his age.
A glare at Balban.
Real combat experience against real enemies, not...
The sneer was back in full force.
The seasoned killer experience of a thug backstabbing a merchant.
He stopped, hissing. Partly from aggravation, mostly from the sharp pain which streaked up his spine. He sagged back on his couch, closing his eyes. Balban cleared his throat.
As it happens, it may have turned out for the best in any event. The report we just received from the hand of Lord Venon de Cotre himself also says that Lord Venon de Cotre believes Belisarius may be open to to our mutual cause. He has developed a friendship with Belisarius, he says, and has had many conversations with him in the course of their long voyage to India. The general is filled with bitter resentment at his treatment by Justinian, and has let slip indications of a willingness to seek another patron. His eyes still closed, fighting the pain, Narses listened to the conversation which suddenly filled the dining chamber. An agitated conversation on the part of the Romans. A mixture of cold calculation, babbling nonsense, scheming analysis, wild speculation, and, most of all, poorly hidden fear. All of the Romans in the room, except Narses, were torn and uncertain. To win Belisarius to their plot would greatly increase its chance for success, so they all said aloud. But to do so would also make their own personal prospects that much the dimmer, so they all thought silently. Narses said nothing, nor after a minute or so did he pay any attention to the words. Let them babble and play their witless games. Pointless games. The Grand Chamberlain, old as he was, eunuch that he was, knew beyond the shadow of a doubt that there was no more chance of Belisarius betraying his oath to Justinian. Less chance, much, much less chance, than that a handful of street thugs could cut him down from ambush. The image of Belisarius came to his mind, as sharp as if the Thracian were standing before him. Tall, handsome, well-built. The archetype of the simple soldier, except for that crooked smile and that strange, knowing, subtle gaze. Narses stared up at the ceiling, oblivious to the chatter around him, grimly fighting down the pain. Balban's voice penetrated. So that's it. I think we're all agreed. We'll hope for the success of Lord Venon de Cotre's effort to win over Belisarius. In the meantime, here in Constantinople, we'll step up our efforts to turn his wife Antonina. As you all know, she arrived a month ago from their estate in Syria. Ashatashatru has already initiated contact with her. Narses' eyes remained fixed on the ceiling. He listened to Ajatashatru. It went well, I think, for a first approach. She was obviously shaken by my hint that Emperor Justinian is plotting with the Malwa to assassinate Belisarius while he is in India, far from his friends and his army. I'm to meet her again soon while she is still in the capital. John of Cappadocia's voice, coarse, hot.
If that doesn't work, just seduce the slut. It seems the supposedly reformed whore hasn't changed her ways a bit. Not according to Belisarius' own secretary Procopius, at any rate. I had a little chat with him just the other day. She's been spreading her legs for everybody since the day her doting husband left for India.
Lewd laughter rippled around the room. Narses rolled his head on the couch slightly, just enough to bring John of Cappadocia under his reptilian gaze.
Not for you, she hasn't, and never will, or for anyone, I suspect. Only a Cretan would believe that malicious gossip, Procopius.
Narses levered himself upright and onto his feet.
I'm leaving, then, he announced.
He nodded politely to all the men in the room except John of Cappadocia. Courtesy was unneeded there, and would have been wasted in any event. The Praetorian prefect was oblivious to Narses. His eyes were blank, his mind focused inward on the image of the beautiful Antonina. So Narses simply stared at the Cappadocian for a moment, treasuring the sight of that twisted obsession. When the time came, the eunuch knew, after the triumph of their treason, John planned to finally sate his lust for Antonina. Narses turned away. The Cappadocian's guard would be down then. It would be the perfect time to have him murdered. Fierce satisfaction flooded him. In his own bitter heart, hidden away like a coal in his icy mind, Narses had compiled a list of all those he hated in the world. It was a very, very, very long list. John of Cappadocia's name ranked high on that list. Narses would enjoy killing him. Enjoy it immensely. The pleasure would alleviate, perhaps, the pain from his other crimes. The pain from killing Belisarius, whom he admired deeply. The agony from Theodora's murder, which would leave him in the end shrieking on his deathbed. The servant helped him don his cloak before opening the door. Narses stood in the doorway, waiting for the servant to fetch his palanquin from the stables in the back of the villa. He glanced up. The night sky was clear, cloudless, open, unstained. Murder them he would, nonetheless, or see to the doing of the deed. Behind him, dimly, he heard John of Cappadocia speaking. He couldn't make out the words, but there was no mistaking that coarse, foul voice. Foul noise and unstained sky swirled in the soul of Narses. Images of a murdered Cappadocian and a murdered Thracian vanished. The cold, still face of the eunuch finally twisted, unbridled. There was nothing reptilian in that face now. It was the face of a warm-blooded beast. Almost a child's face, for all its creases and wrinkles, if a child's face had ever borne such a burden of helpless rage. Cursed, hated ambition. He would destroy himself for that cannibal. The palanquin was here. The four slaves who carried it waited in silent obedience while the servant assisted Narses into the cushioned seat. The palanquin began to move. Narses leaned back into the cushions, eyes closed. His back hurt.